making triple-decker Eggo extravaganzas at sunrise, watching Westerns together before we doze off. But I know you're getting older. Growing. Changing. And I guess, if I'm being really honest, that's what scares me. I don't want things to change.
How did it strike you when you first read what you were going to be reading to her?
There's something so moving about this show. Not even anything in the writing or anything we're doing. Just the fact that the kids are getting older. You literally watch these children grow up in front of your eyes. And you have this character at the center of it just being like, I don't want you guys to grow up. And I think there's something so basically primal about that as a parent.
Welcome to That Scene with me, Dan Patrick, an Amazon original podcast where I get to talk to Hollywood's top actors and directors about some of the most iconic scenes that have defined their careers, helped shape the cinematic landscape, and even become fixtures in pop culture. On today's episode, we're joined by actor David Harbour. David was born in White Plains, New York, and began his professional acting career on Broadway in 1999 when he was 24 years of age. As he worked his way into the Hollywood system through supporting roles, Harbour had all but given up on, quote, making it. That is until he went into an audition for the role of Sheriff Jim Hopper on the Netflix series Stranger Things. Stranger Things' first season was created in 2016 by the Duffer Brothers and quickly became one of Netflix's most popular series. In its third season, in 2019, it was viewed by more than 64 million households. Harbour stars in the series alongside Winona Ryder, Millie Bobby Brown, and Finn Wolfhard. The success of Stranger Things accelerated David's career, earning him leading roles in movies like Hellboy, Marvel's Black Widow, and Steven Soderbergh's No Sudden Moves. The scene in question today comes during the finale of season 3 of Stranger Things, when Hop sacrifices himself to save the town and the people he loves. But the real emotional gut punch comes when Eleven finds the letter left behind. You know, when that letter to Eleven is pretty powerful. How did it strike you when you first read what you were going to be reading to her?
The funny thing about this particular scene is it came halfway through the season. Like when we shot the original stuff of him on the bed talking to Mike and Eleven and reading the initial speech, it hadn't even been written, that part that he was supposed to say. And it really only happened as we were shooting that episode 8 came in and I saw that there was this whole rest of the letter. And they just stumbled on this thing in the writer's room where they were like, what if there was another piece of that letter? I mean, a little Easter egg thing is you can go back and look at him reading the letter on his bed when he's rehearsing it. And when we had shot that, there was just a little paragraph and they actually had to go in and CGI a whole extra bit of it so that you could believe that there was a lot more written on there that he didn't get to say. There was something about that letter that was so earnest and so personal. And again, one of the things that I think was so perfect that really sums him up is he just says it in the letter. I mean, he just says, I don't want things to change. There's something so moving about this show. Not even anything in the writing or anything we're doing, just the fact that the kids are getting older. You literally watch these children grow up in front of your eyes. And you have this character at the center of it just being like, I don't want you guys to grow up. And I think there's something so basically primal about that as a parent.
I don't want things to change. So I think maybe that's why I came in here, to try to maybe stop that change. To turn back the clock, to make things go back to how they were. But I know that's naive. It's just not how life works. It's moving, always moving, whether you like it or not. And yeah, sometimes it's painful. Sometimes it's sad. And sometimes, it's surprising.
my stepdaughters now are 8 and 9, and there's just something so precious about them. But you see them each week, it seems like they get more sophisticated. And there's, you know, of course, there's beauty in that, but there's also just something tragic, like, oh, I wish you could just stay a puppy.
A puppy gets doubles in size in a couple of weeks. Like, you see the puppy get bigger right in front of you. Denzel didn't get older in front of you.
A little bit, but not much. You're right.
He still looks pretty good.
Yeah, exactly. Because I think time really is the biggest villain and the most profound thing in our lives. I mean, it gives everything meaning. It's also the villain that we're constantly fighting against. It's like everything breaks down over time, like my body and my mind. I mean, throughout the season, we see him like eating potato chips on the couch, yelling at children, just being a nasty guy, even to Joyce and all these people that love him and that he loves. And you don't quite really understand what it's about until you really get to the core of it that he arrives at, which is that I'm so tired of things changing. He had such a beautiful, idyllic life with this young daughter of his, and then things dramatically change, and he's so terrified of change now.
Here's what's gonna happen. I'm gonna drive you home, and I'm gonna speak, and you're going to listen. And then maybe by the end of it, maybe if you're lucky, maybe I will continue to allow you to date my daughter.
What do you take away from that first time you saw Eleven read that letter?
I didn't get to see her shoot it, so I really just shoot my portion of it, and then I watch the show along with everybody else when it comes out.
That's the first time you saw her that in that scene?
Yeah, and we shoot a lot in order. So I shot that big fight, and I have like little things like that. And then I shot my sequence in the cabin towards the end. I hadn't seen her for months at the end of the shoot, and then for 6 months in post-production. So yeah, I just watched it along with everybody else when it came out. It's beautiful. I mean, Millie and I have always had sort of a special relationship because I knew her when she was so young, and I knew her before any of this big fame hit. You know, I have a real protective feeling for her. I have a real, like, you know, worry about her. I worry about her and the fame and all that she has to struggle with. And I've just always felt this kind of deep fatherly affection for her. So, you know, it's on one hand wonderful to see her do this beautiful job. It's so moving. And on the other hand, I can really only see her as this Eleven character and to see her in that pain. I mean, I remember even that scene where she's wandering around at the end of the, after Joyce comes out, Hopper's dead, and she's looking for him. And I remember, you know, just what an awful thing to have this innocent little creature that's been holed up finally find someone who cares about her and takes care of her, and to lose that person.
So you know what? Keep on growing up, kid. Don't let me stop you. Make mistakes, learn from them. And when life hurts you, because it will, remember the hurt. The hurt is good. It means you're out of that cave. But please, if you don't mind, for the sake of your poor old dad, keep the door open 3 inches.
And I couldn't help but think back to when we're first introduced to your character. That guy couldn't have raised a daughter. But a couple of years later, like, what happened with that transformation? And I didn't know if real life helped you raise a daughter or TV help you raise real daughters in real life.
Yeah, it's much more the latter. Like, TV definitely helped me in my life. I'm very much a New York sort of city rat. I liked my freedom, my independence. And then it was really this part that did change a lot of that perspective. You know, the show sort of opened my heart in a lot of different ways. And one of the ways that it did was it started to make me realize how thin my existence was without a family. The fact that this guy was maturing into a father sort of was something clearly that my subconscious was sort of crying out to do. And I think it's partially why things are successful, is because there's some unique alchemy between the performer and the role. And I feel like there was something in Hopper that had this deep need for family. And there was something in me that had it too, but that I wasn't even aware of. And then as I began to explore this role, the role allowed me to do that in my real life. It's kind of like it was a nice test run.
But thematically, the show's about found family.
Yes, it is. I think one of the most interesting things about Hopper that I've been playing with through the seasons, and we'll have to see where this goes, is that there's also something to do with blood family that is different than anything else. And I think it's why we're haunted when we have, you know, you can have a found family and yet you still have like an absent father or an absent mother in a sense. And I think you're still haunted by that for your whole life. You know, Eleven becomes Hopper's daughter and he loves her in a deep, deep way. But also when you substitute something like that, it almost makes you more haunted about your blood daughter and her death. So in a way, there is a maturing and a sort of good feeling around that. And underneath it, there's this feeling like, you know, your blood family will never quite be replaced. That is sort of the haunted quality that continues to pulse through their relationship a little bit.
How much input do you have in the script? How much did you have in this season coming up that you could say, how about, or let's try this instead?
Yes. I mean, they write beautiful scripts. They direct beautifully. They have great ideas. And they're also very collaborative. So coming in, I can do a lot of what I want and change around a lot of different stuff. And again, a lot of it is simple moments, ideas about things. The scripts are so good when they come in, though. It's rare on these. I like to change a lot of stuff. I tend to feel like I'm, you know, pretty smart about this stuff, but usually they're smarter than I am. They come up with great stuff and I just read it and I'm just like, this is great. But I can change sort of whatever I want, really.
What's it like to pick up the script and realize you're dying?
We had always talked about this, you know, and I, on interviews, I had to say for about a year that I was like, not sure. And blah, blah. But I have always talked to them about this arc of resurrection.
Wait, when do you know that you're not really dying?
I mean, me and these guys, the Duffer Brothers, are unnaturally close in a way that I've rarely heard showrunners and actors as close as me and these guys. I think it's partially because they were really nobodies when we started this show, and I was a nobody too, in a sense. And so we kind of came up together and feel like a kinship and a brotherhood around that. And I've known the arc of it since the very first frame. And in fact, when we were doing that first season, we were all so scared and we never thought we'd get picked up for a second season, but we would sit around and fantasize about what it could be. And they told me a lot about what it could be and this and that and the other thing. So when the third season rolled around, we talked a lot about these ideas of resurrection. Even from the first season, when Joyce comes in and says to him that she's missing her son, he just doesn't want to look for the kid. And at some point, I started to realize, I was like, Hopper's kind of a piece of shit. Like in the beginning of the thing, like he's really trying to kill himself and he has to die.
99 out of 100 times, kid goes missing. The kid is with a parent or a relative.
What about the other time?
What?
You said 99 out of 100. What about the other time? Joyce. The one.
Joyce, this is Hawkins, okay? You want to know the worst thing that's ever happened here in the 4 years I've been working here? Do you want to know the worst thing? It was when an owl attacked Eleanor Gillespie's head because it thought that her hair was a nest.
Just find my son, Hop. Find him.
When he finds Will, he gets resurrected in a sense, and he finds himself and he finds his purpose. But I've always felt like the Hopper that was had to die in a sense. And the great thing about sci-fi is you get to do this wacky resurrection thing where, like in Lord of the Rings, Gandalf the Grey descends into darkness with the Balrog devil and then reemerges as Gandalf the White. And I always thought it would be, we had always talked about this idea of like him having this fatherly angst and this whole thing and getting bigger and then like really going down with the devil and then reemerging. So, but yeah, I knew he was going to have a very emotional big scene, but I knew that he also wasn't really dead.
Well, who is Hopper then after the resurrection?
Well, don't you, wouldn't you like to know? I mean, he's being rebirthed this season. He's in a particularly brutal world. He's also gone from being a police officer to being a prisoner. And he's in a foreign land. We're going to see a lot of new colors from him and a lot of old, old, deep colors that we haven't really explored. There are these boxes in the basement of season two that have some words on them. And we go into a lot of that backstory that we haven't seen. And we wanted to have a resurrection, to have him explore this new plumage, shed some of that older skin, and really become more of the man that he needs to be for the final push.
I saw some Indiana Jones in there later, and like season three, now you're kind of, you got the hat on, you're kind of embracing Indiana Jones a little bit. Is that by design?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, we love the Spielberg movies. That's the Duffer's whole thing is, you know, they're doing Goonies, E.T., Indiana Jones, and my character has always occupied that space of Indiana Jones.
What's your name?
He's Jim Hopper. Chief Jim Hopper.
Yeah, I've got Jim Hopper.
But we really did this kind of Magnum P.I. thing with him the last season with the Hawaiian shirt or the 80s type shirt and this mustache, because the original conception, when he goes out and buys new clothes, we were like, this is too much. At first, she went to the mall and went to Banana Republic. Back before it was like the Banana Republic. I don't know if you remember Banana Republic in the 80s, but Banana Republic in the 80s had like elephant tusks and like jungle gear, like jungle photographer vests and stuff. So we had Flo, his secretary, get him like a full-on Indiana Jones practically costume from Banana Republic. And then we saw it in the fittings and we were like, this is just too much. We got to stop nodding so much. But I mean, we love that movie. I just love that movie. And I love Harrison Ford in general. So there's so many homages to, you know, Nick Nolte and all these other guys, but especially to Harrison Ford and what he did with Indiana Jones.
Now, did you stay in Russia to film Black Widow?
I mean, it is wacky that I'm doing two projects in Russian prisons, but they are Stranger Things prison is in Lithuania. And then the Black Widow stuff is primarily on stages in London.
So you're well-versed in Russian prison.
I'm unfortunately well-versed in Russian prisons.
Well, you didn't major in Russian at Dartmouth, did you?
No, I have no relationship to Russia. I've read some Dostoevsky and some Chekhov, and that's about where my Russian, yeah, ends.
How long did it take before you told Winona that you had a crush on her?
I mean, it was pretty immediate. Like, you try to play it cool. I've worked with a lot of big celebrities throughout my career. And, you know, you try to play it cool the first couple days and pretend like you're just a couple actors. But it was pretty early on. I think it was one of our long shoots where you just start to get comfortable.
What do you say? Friday, 8 o'clock?
Elle likes to watch Miami Vice on Fridays. It starts at 10, so I can't be out late on Friday.
Okay, well, how about 7 then?
7 Enzo's Friday. I meet you there.
No, you pick me up.
Picking you up 7 p.m. Friday.
Yeah, it's a date.
Just for clarification, just because I mean, just if when you say date, just so that we're crystal clear about things, so there's no confusion. Yeah.
Stop talking or I can change my mind.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
We had a real chemistry right from the bat. I think it was the first night. We were in LA after we'd both been cast, and the Duffers, we all went out to dinner. She's such a sweet, very affectionate, very open woman for being such a big star. And she just kind of grabbed me and we talked for like 5 hours. I remember the Duffers were like trying to get us to go. They were like, we're done with dinner. We've been done with dinner for 3 hours. And you guys are just, but I have a real chemistry, a real affection for her, but I tried to play it cool. And then I just, you know, blurted out at some point, like, I love you. I think you're great.
And then you wait for her response back, though, don't you? Don't you hope that she says something nice back? Or does it just hang there?
No, I'm like a five-year-old boy. I just run away.
How do you think you got cast? What do you think you did during your audition that got you this role?
Or with Stranger Things?
Yeah.
Carmen Cuba, the casting director, was very interested in me for a role, and this thing came about. They sent me the script. I thought the script was extraordinary, and they wanted me to read for it. So I went in, and I mean, I guess I had gotten to a certain point in my career where I was pretty tired of not getting cast in things that I felt very connected to, and kind of getting cast as like the supporting guy running with a gun chasing Denzel and stuff. So I was pretty cynical, to be honest. And I guess I wore a hat because I felt like this guy is such an alcoholic and a pill popper that he wouldn't want people to see his eyes. He'd always want to be sort of shielded. And so I wore a hat, and Carmen and I read the scene once, and you know, she was like, that was good. Do you want to try one without the hat so we can kind of see your eyes? And I was like, no. So we did another one just with the hat. You know, it's sometimes those things where you don't care. I didn't think I would get this. At that point, Netflix had House of Cards with Kevin Spacey and Orange is the New Black. And I really thought they were looking for kind of a big star for this. And I didn't think there was really any shot of me getting it. So I kind of, in a sense, threw it away and I think that was part of what made the audition so relaxed and special.
Gosh, looking back, if you had really gone after it, do you think you would have screwed it up?
I mean, I think that's the cruel irony of this entire business is just that, you know, the more you want it, the less they want you. So, yeah, there was something about that, you know, who cares quality that I think made me very attractive.
Do you have a nightmare audition story?
So many of them. I mean, I can't even, you know, I've been called just terrible. I mean, people just have thought I was just awful. Normally when people don't like you, they just let you go and everything. But there are people out there that are just cruel and awful for years and years and years.
But did you take names? And
I mean, you know, at the time you take a name. I remember all these at the time, and you're just like, I will never, when I get big, I will never, and that person will suffer. And that goes on for like a month, and then you're just like, whatever. And there are people that I see now that are successful, very successful, and I was like, I was gonna take that guy, and you're like, whatever, like, let him, there's room for all of us.
Are you any different as an actor from when you didn't think you could get these roles? I know you're always working on your craft, but are you that much of a different person actor than you were, let's say, 5 years ago?
When your narrative is validated, it gives you a certain confidence. And the fact that people want what you have to say gives you a certain relaxation and exploring as opposed to trying new things. I'm less trying out new things, which it was more of what I needed before. And now you've become this viable thing and you want to explore more of that viable thing. In a sense, I'm different, but I'm still the same guy who's been doing it for 25 years.
But what comes in now has got to be a whole lot different than it was a few years ago.
Yeah. And also it's like, you know, it used to be just projects would come to you and you'd get cast or you'd audition or something. And now it's more about setting things up and you know, working out stories together, which is really exciting because you get to control the narrative even more.
What's it like to die on green screen or using green screen?
The whole thing is silly. You really do have to have a lot of focus and a lot of imagination. A lot of film is this way, especially like horror films. You see people walking down hallways and being all nervous. And you know there's like a crew of 10 people with cameras and like fans and all. So this was, you know, for the Hopper's Big Death, it was like there were huge fans and there was, you know, the cameras like swooping right at you. There's tons of people coming in for touch-ups. It's really hard to maintain, especially for a look like that that's so important. It really does take a tremendous amount of focus. So in a way, yeah, it's really hard.
But it's like, it's make-believe. When you're a kid, you do make-believe. And here you are a grown-up and you're being asked to do make-believe.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, that's the great thing about children is that they can do make-believe. And the problem with acting is you actually have to learn a skill set. By the time you hit around 17 or 18, you start to realize that, you know, Stanislavski talked about this, where it's like the flower of youth and the flower of craft. Like young people can do extraordinary things when they sit down at a tea table and they have a tea party. Whereas adults, we're just like, you know, we don't have that same kind of imagination. You have to train it. It's very, gets much harder the older I get.
Do you keep anything from the set? Are you a hoarder at all? That Stranger Things, you keep anything?
A little bit. I mean, I used to keep costume pieces, but now I don't do that anymore. Even when they give you like a nice suit or something, because I, whenever I wear it out, I just am reminded of that character. It's a weird thing. There's one very specific prop this season that's a big spoiler if I told you what it was. It's like, it's a crazy, terrific prop. And I begged the prop guys for that, and they finally gave it to me. I'm very excited.
Have we seen this prop before, though?
You have not seen it. No, it's a very new thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'll tell you after this thing comes out. I'll tell you which one it was.
And what about the truck? Like, do you want to keep Hop's truck?
I love that Chevy Blazer. Yeah, I love that truck. Although it's not six shift, which annoys me.
That's not any fun. What kind of cassette tapes did you have in that?
I mean, he's a big Jim Croce fan. I feel like he's a big 70s, like Jim Croce. I think he'd even listen to like some rock and roll in terms of like, you know, Thin Lizzy or something.
Like Bad Bad Leroy Brown or something like
that? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Baddest man in the whole damn town?
He's, you know, Indiana. And then like, yeah, I mean, he doesn't have the greatest taste in music because he would have been in his 30s when he discovered Jim Croce. And I think all our music taste becomes horrible after about 24. So yeah, I think I think Jim Croce probably even listened to some Simon and Garfunkel and stuff. A lot of what I do with that, even like Kenny Rogers or something. I mean, I don't know what Indiana boys would listen to. That seems to be what the palette would be for me.
I'm trying to think of Indiana bass, and John Mellencamp might have been a big deal back then.
That's interesting. I feel like he's such a product, like Hopper's such a product of the 70s. Like when I listen to music, I don't know that I'm listening to stuff from like 2015 on. I'm like more into like 90s and like 2000s music. I think just a product of when you're in your 40s or 50s, I don't think you're that on the cutting edge of things anymore.
What about Glenn Campbell for Hop?
Oh, that's good. I like that. Wow, this is good. I'm calling you next time.
And you play a dad in Black Widow. So you've like, you're embracing that you're going to be typecast from here on out. That you're.
I do like the fact that I'm being embraced for a certain thing, but also you do somewhat want to fight against it. One of the interesting things about Hopper this season, although you do see a lot of that fatherly stuff, is I did want to take him back into the warrior realm because, you know, there's something as you get to be the dad role where you know, it's a bit like the dad genes or what, you start to become less of a viable presence in the world and more like, oh, dad, like someone who's like sort of humiliated and like I'm not quite ready for that. I still want to be like a present. So yeah, I struggle with it a little bit.
Do you think you could take Captain America?
Hell no. I'm too much of a dad for that. I mean, especially Chris Evans at his prime with Captain America. Maybe I could take Anthony Mackie now that the mantle is changing hands. I feel like I'd like to square off against that guy. But yeah, Chris Evans at the height of his game, wielding the Thor hammer, smashing Thanos, I think I'd have a very hard time against that.
The Red Guardian has a dad bod.
Yeah, absolutely. Although I got even bigger for Red Guardian. I mean, there's a shot in that movie, the beginning of the movie, which I just love when you see him. I'm running out and you see my belly running in front of me. And a friend of mine said, was perfect, like a bag of ferrets, like swirling in front of my body. Yeah, I was big. I was 275, 280 when I shot that. As I shot the movie, I lost a little weight and they were able to pad me once I got in that super suit. But, you know, I mean, gaining weight for those movies is a lot of fun, a lot of fun. And then losing it is so difficult. So
wait, was this your Raging Bull moment that you're De Niro here?
A little bit. Yeah, a little bit. You know, you play with those concepts. It's such a trope in film now. It's like, you know, losing weight or gaining weight for a movie that I didn't want to be left out myself. So, yeah.
Well, that's how you win awards there.
Exactly. You know, I got to get this Emmy maybe one day. So I got to do something.
What's your family think of your career as an actor?
Initially, they were very scared about me going into it. They really didn't want me to do this. I was relentless though, and couldn't be, you know, talked out of it. So I waited tables and I was kind of miserable for a while, went through hard times and was very poor. And while my friends were all having families and doing all kinds of stuff, I was in a different place. And now, you know, having some success, it's just great. I think they're really proud of me. And I think they are proud of my tenacity as well. I think everybody's most proud of my tenacity, that, you know, it took a long time for me to be established in a certain way, but I kept at it. And I think that's, I think they think that's wonderful.
But you kind of held off adulthood.
That's true. That's true.
That this business, as goofy as it is, it allows you to get away with stuff because you're an actor.
Exactly. Yeah, you're kind of Peter Pan, you know? And it's funny, like I've always had a somewhat of a complex relationship with adulthood in general, because I tend to feel that a lot of the tragedy of this world comes from adults or adult type behavior. I mean, it tends to be the quote unquote smartest guys in the room that start wars and, you know, do horrible things to the environment and stuff like that. So there's something about that staving off of adulthood that is just in my nature.
I also wonder that you go to Dartmouth. And most parents would go, my son's at Dartmouth. And then my son gets out of Dartmouth. What's your son do who went to Dartmouth? He's waiting tables and he wants to be an actor.
There was a lot of that.
But do you say to mom, hey, I'm going to make you proud one day? Or do you start to then, you know, maybe buy into it? Like, what am I doing? I went to Dartmouth. And I'm waiting tables.
I mean, I was doing avant-garde theater in New York with little theater companies in the, you know, and making my parents donate money to my nonprofit theater production. I mean, it was like humiliating for a nice Westchester boy who went to Dartmouth, you know, when they were all the other guys were eye bankers and stuff like that. I mean, I think I descended into a thick intellectualism about what I was doing was super important compared to what everyone else was doing. That was part of the buffer. And then, you know, and then there was that deep insecurity and fear underneath it. But as I say, like, there was just this relentless drive, and it felt almost like a calling, like you hear people describe the priesthood in these ways, where it really was that I couldn't imagine myself doing anything other than exploring human behavior through narrative and stage and film. I just couldn't imagine anything else.
Emotionally, are you better at showing anger or sensitivity on screen?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose anger comes more naturally to me. But usually underneath that anger is a lot of hurt sensitivity based on just like being a, you know, feeling humiliated like a 4-year-old and not as a man, not being able to express it other than power and control, which is sort of how I was brought up as a man. That like, that's what the way you were supposed to. I mean, I was brought up, my whole family's from Houston, Texas. And I was, you know, I mean, I grew up in New York, but that this sort of blood, you know, philosophy of ours, which was that, you know, boys don't cry and men are a certain way. So yeah, anger comes a lot more natural.
Would you have been able to handle this success 10 years, 15 years ago?
No.
Are you able to handle it now?
I mean, I think now I am. I feel for those kids. I mean, they seem to be doing quite well with it. I'm 46 now. So this attention sort of came like at 40. And there's a particular brand of early 30s male ambition that is so dangerous. I mean, that like, had I gotten successful at 30 as opposed to 40, I feel like it would have been kind of a nightmare. I think there's something about success at 30 where you really do take credit for it. Like your ego really is like, yes, I am something special. You're welcome, world. And I think that when you're 40, you're kind of like, I mean, I'm like, it's hard to take much in life seriously. You know, at a certain point, you realize that it's all just like a bit of a game and a bit of a wheel of fortune that spins us all around. I think any younger than 40, I would have been unbearable. And I'm bad enough as it is. But like, but yeah, it would have been a night.
Thank you, David. I appreciate your time and good luck with the upcoming movies.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
New episodes of That Scene are available exclusively on Amazon Music, and all of Season 1 is available wherever you get your podcasts, so make sure you follow us in the Amazon Music app. That Scene with Dan Patrick, created, hosted, produced by me. Our showrunner and producer is Brendan Pike, edited by Nathan Moody. The show is executive produced by Paul Anderson, Nick Pinella, and Andrew Greenwood. Our associate producers, Bill Ryan and Marvin Prince. That Scene is an Amazon original and a production of Dan Patrick Productions.